This is Shirley Stolz and Marcy Schwartz. We're still with Judge Kaplan. It so happens that he has a little extra time today, and we thought we would take advantage of that because his time is limited, that he can see us at other times. So we're going to try and do a little further today. Okay, let's go on with where we stopped, and that was that you were initially in your freshman year at Hillel.
Yeah. Yeah, I when I came to Penn, I decided I was going to get involved with Hillel. I generally, always been interested in Jewish affairs and so forth. And prior to coming to Penn, I had taught Sunday school for a year back in Uniontown. My senior year in high school, and so I was very, very much aware of being Jewish and that it was important, and so I got active at Hillel, and eventually I became the freshman president. I became president of and I was the freshman class representative to the Hillel Council that they had, And I stayed active in Hillel all 4 years. So that my senior year I was the president of the Hillel Foundation at the University of Pennsylvania, and as such, I was able to participate on the undergraduate council of the university as a representative. Because the I'm not sure how this worked, but they. The other two big organizations, religious organizations, were the Newman Club for the Catholics and the Christian Association, or the CA as they called it, for the Protestant denominations. And I was friendly with the presidents of those groups, and we had a chaplain's council that developed eventually, which I got to serve on as president. But in addition, I got to be on undergraduate council, and at Penn, that was considered to be a quite an honor. And what they would do is you would get what they called a hat. In other words, there were different societies on that university that if you were belonging to these societies, which were honorary or otherwise, you got this hat that you would wear, and there would be a day of the of a certain day of the week. It seems a little ridiculous when you look back on it now. But I was a hat man, as they would say. That was always be an indication of someone who was a big man on campus, you see. And I say man because while there were women at Penn at that time, they definitely had a subordinate position. There was a college for women, and that's where most of the women were. It was a liberal arts part. It was not merged into the College of Arts and Sciences, which was where I was, and so the women that were there were either in the college or they were in the School of Education or they were in nursing, and that was about it. Although occasionally, in other words, women, while they might take an occasional course, they could not graduate from the Wharton School of Finance, as they do today, of course.
And did you have a rabbi at the head of Hillel at that time?
Yeah, we did. At that time, the rabbi was, I remember his name, Rabbi Zemach. And he had come there, I think, from Lancaster, where he had been a rabbi. And this was the year that he was, of course, my favorite story about the rabbi from Lancaster, where they have so many of the Amish people and so forth, and Quakers in that area, where someone asked him, how it was heading up a congregation in that part of the country. And he says, well, I do have a problem. He says, a lot of my congregants have become Quakers. And he says, in fact, some of my best Jews are friends. But I'll tell you something very interesting. Here it was. It was my freshman year was 1946, 47. And then my sophomore year, of course, was 1947-48. Mm-hmm. And we're getting near the end of my sophomore year. Rabbi Zemach has been there for these 2 years. And he's leaving for whatever reason. And we're getting a new rabbi. And as well as I know his name, all of a sudden I can't remember it. And but there's a lot of reasons why I should be remembering his name, as I'm about to tell you. And that's why it really bothers me. It was Rabbi Gordon. And they have scholarships that they give out to Brandeis Camp.
Oh yes.
Brandeis Camp, and there were three Brandeis camps that were functioning at that time. There was one that was located up in Winterdale, Pennsylvania, in the Poconos. Winterdale. There was one in Hendersonville, North Carolina. And then there was one in Santa Susana, California. And the man who had organized this was a man named Shlomo Bardeen. And what it was a camp for adult young Jews to teach them leadership skills so that they should come back to the Jewish community and be leaders in the Jewish community. So I applied for a 1 month scholarship to go to that camp. And I was awarded it.
In Pennsylvania?
And it ended up going to the one in Pennsylvania, in Winterdale, Pennsylvania. So I get to the camp, and who is the director of the camp? Rabbi Gordon, who was, when he was finished there, was going to come back to Penn to be the Hillel rabbi. So I really got a jump on knowing him very quickly, and of course I really, really admired him, and he was just a wonderful man. He was a reform rabbi.
Was that your sophomore year?
This is at the end of my sophomore year.
So you only would have him 2 more years.
Right. At the same time, I applied for a scholarship to the B'nai B'rith youth camp which is in Warwick, New York, I believe. Mm-hmm. I take it back. I was applying to, well, I got this 1 year, 1 month scholarship to Brandeis Camp through the Intercollegiate Zionist Federation, which I was a member of. I was an ISFA member, as they called it. So in addition to Hillel, I was active with and I got that. But I also was interested in trying to go to this camp that the B'nai B'rith was the sponsor of, because through B'nai B'rith Hillel, it was a national camp, and I got a 2 week scholarship to that camp as well, and they succeeded each other, so I was able to go to the one camp, and then from there I went to the other. So this was a real Jewish summer for me.
Were the purpose of B'nai B'rith the same as the
same thing? Yeah.
Oh, that's
It was pretty much the same thing.
So you got a good,
yeah. So when I was at Brandeis Camp, I got selected because I guess Rabbi Gordon realized that here's someone I'm going to know hereafter. They would have someone who would be the officer of the day, who was sort of in charge of the whole camp for that day. You know, ran around with a clipboard and made the announcements and all of that sort of, had a whistle. Yeah, that was very important. And one of the real strict requirements was that no one was allowed out on the lake unless it was supervised and there was a... Well, Shlomo Bardeen was visiting at the camp that time, and I knew it was Shlomo Bardeen, but he was out on the lake. So I had to blow my whistle and say, no one's supposed to be out on the lake and so forth. But... So I was just doing my job, you know.
And
Of course, now they call it the Brandeis Bardeen Camp. After he died, they named the camp after him as well. Of course, I still get solicitation letters from them even now, 50 years later. And of course, the camp is only in Santa Susana, California now.
Have you had reunions?
They have them, but I don't think we've ever gotten that I can remember. But I'll tell you what did emerge from that camp. I'm still living in Uniontown, of course, at this time. That the following summer, or was I already in law school then? I'm trying to remember, but I know what it was. A couple years later, another young woman from Uniontown, Jane Marks, went to Brandeis also. And I guess this is when I was in law school. It may have been between my freshman and senior, or it was one of the summers while I was in law school. They decided they were going to have a folk festival in Uniontown. And they were going to get all the different Jewish groups, all the different ethnic groups to sponsor something. And they were going to have a big, this wasn't a food festival like they have, but this was going to be a production at the stadium, at the high school stadium. And they were going to put on programs of different, musical programs, folk dancing, and so forth and so on. So here, Jane and I, graduates of Brandeis Camp, we could dance a pretty mean hora. We could throw in a little mayim, mayim, mayim in between. So we came back, and I undertook with Jane to organize the Jewish community and kids and to do something for that. So we did. We got and we did folk dancing. We trained the group to do the dance. They were all girls, as it turned out. I couldn't get any guys involved. Although Jane and I did a solo, crossed hands, yeah. And we got Dr. Shine, who was one of the local optometrists, who was a tremendous violin player, and we got him to do the violin rendition that you frequently hear in temple at the high holidays to begin the Yom Kippur service. Come on, tell me what do we call it? In fact, we call that service the Kol Nidre. The Kol Nidre. So he did the Kol Nidre on the violin, which was very impressive. I forget what else we did, but we had a nice little package that we put on for the Jewish.
This is a result of what you had learned, that
we had done at Drana. So the formula worked.
So you really stayed in touch with the Jewish part of the university.
Yeah.
You were there
all the way. And, part of the job, we were like missionaries to the fraternity houses, because the fraternity houses, usually the Jewish fraternity didn't want to have much to do with Hillel. A lot of the Hillel people were what we called the commuters, like you, or your sister, or whatever, whoever. I had this philosophy then, whatever could get you into Hillel, who cares? And I says, if we have ping pong Jews, that's okay with me. If that's why they come there, is to play ping pong, terrific. Some came because we had a great hi-fi system, and they would come and listen to records, and there's a nice library that we built up, and it wasn't too much of a dietary thing like it is today. I mean, the Hillel Foundations is where the kids got to go if they want to keep kosher and so forth.
Right.
They can always go there, but that we would do that.
Together.
Right.
No matter how they came in, everything
right.
was accepted.
That was the idea. And we'd have a carnival, and there were a lot of activities that we had. And Rabbi Gordon was terrific.
He was young.
Yeah, and he had kids that were coming along, and little kids, and his wife. Just a lovely family. And he went on eventually to become a very prominent rabbi of one of the mainline temples in Philadelphia. Yeah, I think it was in Ardmore or there.
Yes,
yeah.
there's such a difference between the members of Hillel, I think, and the members of your fraternity. How did you blend the two?
Well, I mean, everyone in the fraternity, for the most part, was Jewish, of course. These are Jewish fraternities, although we had some non-Jews. Our fraternity was one that was sort of proud of the fact that Pi Lam, that we had non-Jewish members, and in fact, one of our California chapters had a Olympic star. It was actually African American, although they didn't call him African Americans then. Rafer Johnson, and I know that our Dartmouth chapter had a actually was non-Jewish, who was the Rex, which is what we called the president of the fraternity. And of course, the fraternity was organized originally because Jews couldn't get into fraternities, and it was one of the first ones to be organized in the late 1800s. And the idea was it should be something that was open to everyone regardless of religion, so it would have been pretty hypocritical not to take non-Jews into this particular fraternity. But for the most part, it was Jewish. In fact,
some of the fellows probably in the fraternity were interested in some of the activities that
were right, and that's true, exactly. And they were, and of course, I'd use my missionary zeal to get people involved too. And when push came to shove, and they needed support, and we'd have some fundraisers and things like that, the fraternities would support it. In fact, that would be one of their projects. To support Hillel.
Did you live in a fraternity house?
2 years. You couldn't live there your freshman year. You had to live in the freshman dorms at Penn. Mm-hmm. Second year, you went in the fraternity house. Mm-hmm. Third year, you usually moved out. Well, I lived with my roommate who was from Baltimore. We actually had a room in a hotel. It was for students.
Area.
Yeah, I think it was the Marlin. It was up at 40th and Walnut. And then the senior year, we moved back into the fraternity house.
We did. Mm-hmm. Now, when you graduated, at that point, you had already applied for law school?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'd taken the equivalent of what they called the college boards at that time. They weren't college boards. But you did need college boards to get into Penn. I know that. But the what you took then to get in law school was...
Another
group. And I took that, and I guess I did okay, and I got accepted at Pitt Law School.
Is that the one you wanted to go to?
That was the only one I applied to.
Oh.
I had filed an application with Penn as well, but I didn't follow up on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I made up my mind. I was probably going to live back home, so I wanted to go to Pitt.
Right. And when you came back for law school, did you live at home?
No. It was too far away. I mean, I was still in Uniontown then.
Right.
And I roomed with a Gentile fellow from Uniontown who our families, in fact, when my family first moved to Uniontown and when I was born, they lived in an apartment adjacent to this other family, the McDaniel family. And the McDaniel, one of the McDaniel sons and I, he was older than I, he had gone to St. Vincent's. But we knew each other. In fact, I have pictures taken of one of my earlier birthday parties, and little Jackie McDaniel was at the party. Yeah, although he was 2 or 3 years older than I. And so we roomed together our freshman year at law school, and we had a room on Belfield. And then in a rooming house. One of those houses there that I think they tore down to build the Madison. and then the second year we lived on Wallingford Street in a similar large rooming house kind of thing.
Stayed with him all 3 years?
Yeah, second year. And then the third year we actually moved into the Pi Lam house and he came with us. I mean, he wasn't Jewish, but he lived in the fraternity house, and they needed people, and that was right on campus, and that was on Dithreed Street.
That's the policy to accept, I know you said it was in Philly, but I wondered in...
Oh, nationally. It was a national policy.
Oh, it was a national
policy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you stayed at Pitt. What was the nature of the community at that time in terms of... Well, you would only know the law school community.
Well, no, I know the undergraduate community too, because I did get involved at the fraternity house, which were primarily undergraduates. And it's probably because of the undergraduate fraternity that I met my wife. And we at law school, at that time we were in the Cathedral of Learning. The law school classrooms were on the 14th floor. There were professors' offices in the 13th floor, and the library of the law school was on the 15th floor.
Yeah, this was before they built the new.
Yeah, before they built the new law school.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What was the nature of your group in law school in terms of Jewish students, non-Jewish students?
They would mix it up. Pretty well. There wasn't a lot of segregation between among the groups. Of course, there's a tendency to gravitate more with the Jewish students, and in fact, the only thing Jewish that really kept us together in law school was our law fraternity, because at that time, we hadn't quite made the break where you could go to the non-Jewish fraternities. Law fraternities.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined the Tops on Row fraternity, which is now called the Tops on Row Law Society. It had, as part of its coat of arms, it had a mug and dove in it.
Oh, really?
And this was very helpful to me, because through it I got to meet other young Jewish lawyers who had just gotten out.
Mm-hmm.
They'd come back and help us study for courses.
Really?
I remember Bob Rayfield coming back and Mike Herman and working with us.
Volition.
Yeah, they came they just graduated.
Yeah.
And they came back, and there was like a graduate chapter of the fraternity also. And the older lawyers that were here in town would stay involved with it. Guys like all of a sudden I got myself a lapse, but I'll come up with the names eventually. But
was it among the students that were with you? They were mostly Pittsburghers?
Yeah, almost entirely Pittsburghers. There might have been a few that
mm-hmm.
were from just out of town.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I was about as far away as you came.
Okay,
I was all the way from Uniontown.
Yes.
And Pittsburgh was definitely, the law school was very, very much a regional law school at that time.
Yeah.
There weren't too many people that came in. I don't remember having classmates from, like, even Philadelphia
mm-hmm.
or Columbus, Ohio.
Well.
Yeah, it was a well-rated law school. And I think it's higher rated now than perhaps it was then.
It's higher rated now?
I think so. And they have a much more diverse student body.
What was your major interest in law?
You didn't have to, because everyone sort of graduates
in the
general category. There was no emphasis put on one thing or another. There were core courses that you had to take. And if you had told me that I was going to end up being a family law judge, I wouldn't have quite believed that. When you think about it, though, this social work
right.
thing.
Very much
related yeah.
to what they tested you on.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. there becomes a certain logic to that.
So when you finished law school, you just took whatever position you could get, or did you look for certain kinds of law
Well, when I got out of law school, I had to go to the Army. See, when I was in law school, it was from 1950 to 1953. And those are the exact years of Korea, of the Korean War. And while I was in law school, my draft board was after me. And they gave me a 2S, I think is what they called it, rating, which was that would permit me to finish law school. And I remember the chairman of the draft board, meanwhile, was back in Uniontown. But the chairman of the draft board was a high school principal from Fairchance High School, which is one of the communities outside of Uniontown. And I remember his interviewing me, and I told him I'd like to have the opportunity to finish school because I think I'd be worth more to the service when I go in at that time. I'd have a little more to offer. And he was very sympathetic. He said he had a son during World War II who dropped out of college and went to war, and when he came back, never did finish. Which, yeah, I was going to say, well, how about the GI Bill and all the rest of that stuff? Because that's what got everyone into college, was the GI Bill. And of course, it was those people I was in law school with. Where I had some of those people who came back from service and were in my class in law school. And so I got the deferment. And then
you had to go immediately upon graduation.
Immediately. I wanted to have the opportunity to sit for the bar exam, which was given towards the end of July, and I knew that it was going to, and I thought, gee, it would be nice if I could get into the legal branch of the Army, and that permits you to become an officer and so forth. It meant you had to sign on for an extra year in order to do that. No, I was prepared to do that. Mm-hmm. For 1 year out of your life at that age, what the difference does it make if the experience is going to be worthwhile? So I hurried up, and that same summer that I was studying for the Pennsylvania bar, I took off a few days and went down and took the bar examination in Washington, D.C. My wife had an aunt who was married to a retired Army officer. And I was there, and so he sort of knew his way around. But I went down, took the exam, and happily I passed it because not too long after I was called up to go in. In fact, they called me up. In August, I think it was, mm-hmm. And I had, and they really didn't give me, they're supposed to give you 10 days or 14 days or something like that. Right. They didn't give me enough notice. So I, since it's a loophole, but you know, already I'm learning to be a lawyer, so I figured I said, yeah, right. So then they were going to call me up again. You know, they weren't going to let any grass grow under the feet, so they gave me another date that they were calling me up. Trouble is, it was Yom Kippur. So that was a legal out also for a Jewish person. Then they were calling me like the following week or something like that. We can't take you with your regular group. You're just going to have to go. You know? So I did. So I went in like towards the end of September. And the induction center, which was Fort Meade in Maryland, between Washington and Baltimore. And meanwhile, I found out I had passed the D.C. bar. So I had all my papers prepared to apply, but I had to go to the Pentagon to file these papers. So I had to get a pass while I was at the induction center, which they never gave to new recruits who just came in. But here's where the uncle came in handy. He knew someone who knew someone, and I was able to get off for the weekend, and on Monday morning, I went to the Pentagon and deposited my papers. I was dressed in my private uniform, never before laundered, that I'd just gotten from the quartermaster. And I walked into the Pentagon with all these generals walking around and everything else. You know, my arm was breaking already from saluting. Went up to the Judge Advocate General's office, deposited my papers, and went back to the Army. Natalie came in that weekend, so we were at least able to spend a day. Yeah. And by the way, I never did tell you how I met my wife and got married to her.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah, you're going to have to go back, though. Okay.
But I want to know what happened. Where did you go from there?
So there I am. I went from the reception center, and then they have, you had sort of a choice of like three things you could have done.